Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have no idea why it was called a pirate fay. I'm here because of the love that I had for my dear pirate Alex, you know, and that's why I'm here. I don't know why we called it that or not, but tonight we're going to take the pirate's oath, where everybody takes their left hand and put it over their right eye and slowly says the pirate's oath, "I will not drink again, man," you know. I want to thank all you guys for having me out here. All the greeters that were out here greeting, and the people that were in here greeting me. And there was actually two men in the restroom that greeted me, and they gave me a warm welcome. And we found out that there was no paper towels in the men's room. So after we washed our hands, we did what most groups do, and that we begin to hug one another. You know what I mean? So I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Eric and Derek for picking me up at the airport. I'm not very well known, I guess, out here, so they had to bribe two girls to form a greeting party for me, you know, over at the airport, and I wanted to thank them for that. But I'm glad to be here, really. My sponsor tells me, and I want to thank Carl for a lovely talk. He gave a great talk. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 31 years and not amount to a damn thing. So, you know, I'm not much in Alcoholics Anonymous, but my sponsor tells me that I'm all I think about, that's for sure, you know. I got to take a walk today out there in Paisley, and that was nice. I dared not leave the sidewalk, though. That's a damn sure, boy, because it's hard to get. Every time I would try to cross the street and look to see if the car was over, some son of a bitch would come this way, you know. So I stayed on the sidewalk the whole place, you know, the whole time and everything. But I had a great meeting last night, and I stayed up pretty late last night. And we have some new people here. And while I was up watching TV last night, I was watching CNN. And they came out with a cure for alcoholism in Switzerland that comes in the form of a pill. So you new guys, hang in there. There's hope on the horizon, you know. My first thought is I wondered what two would do. You know what I mean? And can you crush them up and maybe, you know, get this thing going, you know? But, and then while I was walking around the neighborhood, I seen a Jehovah Witness store or whatever it is over there, place. And I was in Washington a month ago. And I was sharing a hotel with 1,000 Jehovah's Witnesses, and which is nothing wrong with that, you know. But around 3 o'clock in the morning, I had this desire to grab a big book and go door to door in the hotel. You know what I mean? You know, Bill and Bob love you. You know, just not that I want to get back or anything like that. You know. So I'm glad I'm here. And I'm just glad to be out in Scotland and seeing a bunch of old friends and new friends and stuff like that. I come from good people. I loved my parents after I began to finally love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what that word meant. I was born in Detroit, and I came out to California when I was about 4 years old, and I was put in a foster home. And my parents got together. And they got me out of that orphanage and stuff. And my mom's a dear lady. My mom's a sweet little lady. And my mom used to eat diet pills and speed and just run around the house all night long, you know, and mow the neighbor's lawn. And, you know, she grabbed a power edger one night and did the whole block. She just took off, man, you know. And just a busy lady, you know, and no matter what time you got up, she was up doing stuff, man, you know, cleaning stuff with your toothbrush and, you know. And she used to love to eat that speed and make these big afghans. And everything in the house had fresh afghans on it. You know, the chairs had afghans, the couches had afghans. If there was any golf clubs, they had a poodle's head knit over that, you know. And if there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And just a busy lady. And our house was very small. And she had a little room. And you can hear her all night just going to town, man, you know. And the diet was working. She was down to a stick, you know. But I loved being around my mom. And when you eat that much speed, you have a lot of hobbies, you know. And you do them at the same time, you know what I mean? You're just busy doing it, you know. And one of my mom's favorite hobbies was to eat that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles. Not the 3,000 pieces, you know, the 30,000 pieces, you know. And of the Mojave Desert, you know. And she would get excited. It's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know. And run down to the drugstore and get her prescription filled and get a carton of Raleigh cigarettes, because there was coupons that she saved on the back of them to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And she'd come back home and eat that speed and peroxide her hair. And she had one muumuu she had her entire life, you know. And she would just eat that speed and put together this jigsaw puzzle. And if she found a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that son of a, you know, and just wedge that thing in there, you know. And what would happen to me growing up is I became very attracted to the lady and just loved being around my mom. And I had no idea it was because I wanted to avoid my dad, you know. But I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, for which I wish would be the last time. And I would get together with a sponsor and a home group and that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would start that fourth step, which my book calls as a fact-finding process. And they're not kidding, because we are dealing with the facts now. Not the fact that you ran into poles and drank a lot and fell off the stool, but the way you were when you weren't drinking. The facts about the alcoholic. And I would find myself taking on traits as a young kid and bringing them right into my adult personality. And one of these defects of character that I found is what I would do with people who would give me love and attention and affection. And it started with my mom. And what I would do is I would play you like a fiddle. I would use my mom like a fiddle. And there would never be a time too old, too inconvenient, or an age too old for me not to put the tap on that lady. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it was like to be a young man, maybe 17 or 18 years old, and be put away for a small period of time. And when you come out of those places, you're supposed to show up at home on Monday. And I don't. I show up on a Thursday, and I don't even show up at home. I show up at my mom's place of business. And what she's doing is she's running a dry cleaners. And she's cleaning people's houses. And I'm ashamed of my mom. But I'm not too ashamed to show up on a Thursday morning, standing in front of a parking lot, which is about from here to those back doors where I can see my mom. And it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I got that drunken mud on, and I'm standing there, and the only thing that I can see through that rain is my mom. And the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I wait till all the customers to leave the stand there, and I make a move to go see my mom. And the only thing that I say is, you know, I ask for that $1 or $2. And one more time, I startle my mom with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in that young lady's life. And without skipping a beat, she opens up her little wallet, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League baseball team. And the only picture that she would have of me until I meet you guys. And she peels off that $1 and $2. And I grab that money and I run off to Long Beach, California, where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight in Paisley is you take this same man and you bring me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, where every action that I take, my life depends on. And you better make no mistake about that. And you stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to ask you this if you're new. How come, with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any length, if I was new and I'm in a meeting like this, if you were to put the secretary of this meeting that same distance as me and my mom, I need to ask you something. How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask the secretary for a job and a meeting that's going to save my life, but I can use my mom and walk that same distance time and time and time again? And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that it's been my experience, and that's all I have, and that's all I'm going to share this weekend. It's been my experience that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a man with 31 years to have a routine of meetings and jobs in every one of those meetings. Not so that I can run off to Scotland and tell you about it. For one reason and one reason only. And if I don't say anything this whole weekend, remember this. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And if you stay around here long enough, you will witness that. There is no safe place for us to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in the middle of these steps. There is no wandering place for us. And I never knew that. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But if I can get together with a sponsor and a home group and that book and find out that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found a key to life. Because the moment that I began to serve the thing that was giving me life, I couldn't keep it from bleeding in every area of my life. There's a miracle here. And it's one that you can't bring about. And it's one that you can't even pray about. But it's one you must do something about. And I had no idea. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad's drinking did not scare me. I knew he found something. My dad was a happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He loved to get drunk and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, which I think is a lost art in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, that old window-climbing alky, you know. There's nothing like that alky trying to sneak into his house, banging on that window for 2 hours, hoping it's his house, you know what I mean? And my dad was one of those, and he was in a refinery worker, so he had these big boots on, and he was always sneaking in that house, and one night he snuck in there, man, and he brought that boot down right on my chest, and I grabbed that boot, and I told him, I said, Dad, I said, you know, why don't you have Mom get you a set of keys? You know, my God, you know, she's up anyway, you know, I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And my dad just, my dad was one of those guys, man. He was just, you know, he read my inventory when I was new, too. He says, you know, you don't know how good you've got it. Well, that's the name of the game with me. I've never known how. I've never been a guy strapped with gratitude. I've got to be reminded today of the good life that we have. If I've been strapped with anything, it's a 5-inch belt of lazy ass. You know what I mean? That I do. I mean, I don't wake up thinking about what good I can do for God. I wake up and I think about my nap. You know what I mean? You know, everything works around 2:30, you know. And my dad caught on to that, man. He used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough. And he did. He had a heck of a life. His father died in a drunken convulsion and choked on his tongue. And his mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And his job was to take care of his little brother. And he wanted to marry my mom. He wanted to go in the service and marry my mom and bring her out to California, you know, and live a life of which that his children would never have to want for anything. And so they worked two jobs at a time and stuff like that. And the only thing that I whined about was that they weren't around, that they never said that they loved me. Their actions showed that. But because they weren't giving me group hugs every night, you know what I mean? I didn't feel any affection, you know what I mean? And that's the type of ego that I had. I'm a loser, you know, which is L-O-S-E-R, which is Greek for quitter, you know. I'm a loser. I've always been a loser, and I've known that. And I've never felt like I've had anything going for me and always felt inadequate, you know. With an ego like mine and that loser attitude is what happens is you grow up through life and you do average things expecting standing ovations. You know what I mean? You go to work and you think the boss is up in the office going, oh my God, look at that. My God. Look at that Eric. Boy, he just, you know, he worked for 8 hours, man. They don't make him like that anymore. You know what I mean? And And he took a half-hour lunch. My God, he's going to... We got to get more of those, you know what I mean? And you grow up through life expecting standing ovations for stuff you should be doing anyway. You know what I mean? I mean, I even in my, you know, in my little home today, my little precious wife, Rosie, you know, not too long ago, I put a toilet seat on for her because I don't use it. You know what I mean? Yeah, I thought, you know what, I'll buy her a nice new, a nice maple wood toilet seat, you know. And I remember wrestling and putting that thing on, and I hurt my finger too doing that, you know. And I sweat and I toiled for a good 20 minutes, man. It tore me up, you know. And this beautiful toilet seat I'd made for my Rosie, and, you know, I could just picture her, what she's going to do on it and stuff, you know. I go all the way, man, you know, and the joy that it would bring me seeing her nestle down, you know, and me and Rosie are busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, we're passing each other in the hallway at night and stuff like that, and every night when we'd come to our home from our meetings, I would go into the bed, you know, and she would go into the restroom, you know, and she would come out, and she would never say anything about that toilet seat. Week after week, month after month, this selfish, self-centered woman, you know. And I'm on the bed, and it's just eating me alive, you know. I'm thinking, my God, what are these women teaching her, you know? Just use that son of a bitch all you can, you know what I mean? Just take, 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 you know. And after about 4 months, she waddled out of there, and I said, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood you've been sitting on in there, you know what I mean? She goes, I know, and it's loose, too. You know what I mean? Drove me nuts, you know. But I've been like that my entire life, you know. And I was a good kid for about 11 years, and I couldn't handle it anymore. You know what I mean? I don't feel good by doing good. Everybody else is pleased as punch that I'm doing good. And say, oh, look at him. I'm going nuts. I don't feel good doing good. I need a little more. I've got a busy head. I've got a head that loves to chat. I don't know about you guys. I got the head that no matter how tired I am, boy, that old head wants to just, hey, wake up. Come on, you're up anyway. Let's talk about when you're a baby and bring you right up to date, for God's sakes. You know what I mean? And people like me, we just go, you know, what the hell? We just did that the night before. You know what I mean? And I've always had a busy head, and it's never told me anything good. And I'm about 11 years old, and I can run like a deer, and I can play baseball, and I'm doing everything else that all these other folks are doing, but they seem to grasp and develop a manner of living. They seem to know where they're going. I never know where I'm going, because the moment I start planning where I would like to go and what I would like to do, I talk myself out of it in 15 seconds. You'll never do that. Oh, yeah, no, you can't cut that. No, you won't do that. And I wind up doing nothing. I wind up doing nothing and feeling crappy about doing nothing. And every time I think about doing something, I talk myself out of it, and I just stay in that little pit. You know what I mean? And at 11 years old, man, you know, my dad sneaking in the window one my time, you know, and I snuck out, you know. And at 11 years old, there was four of us in the garage, and we passed around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I found what I was looking for. I was a natural. Bobby was a natural at football. Susie was a natural at playing the tuba. And I was a natural at that stuff, man. Nobody had to talk me into it. Nobody had to bribe me. I went to it just like a magnet, man. And I took a shot of that Four Rose whiskey, and I stepped into the safest place that I would ever know. It was shut off that goofy head, and it made being Larry all right. And I've never been okay being Larry. I didn't even like the name. I wanted to be Mike. You know what I mean? No, I did. I just hated me right from the get. You know what I mean? That doctor slapped me and he looked at me. Why are you crying? You know what I mean? I remember running away from home at 9 years old, and my dad told my mom, I thought you said he was gone. You know what I mean? He was happy as hell, you know. And I've never been happy about being me, man. And I didn't know what to do about that. You know, I'd look in that mirror and I looked like Howdy Doody. My ears were big. I had all these zits on. And I take a shot of Four Rose whiskey and Howdy Doody turns into James Dean in three drinks, man. And I love the effect that alcohol produced in me immediately. And I took a shot of that Four Rose whiskey that night with these four other guys. I never laughed so hard my entire life. just laugh for hours, man, right from the gut. I never threw up so much as I did my entire life. I was throwing up stuff I ate when I was 9 months old was coming out, man. Just spraying it, you know. I remember dancing and kissing my first Latin woman, you know, and it was my aunt. You know? Come here. Laid one on her, you know. Made my uncle a little edgy, you know, having, where is he, man? You know what I mean? And I knew, you know, after that night, and I remember coming home, and my dad just used to love to wail on me, you know, if we did anything wrong. You smarted off at your mom, you know, he'd let you have it. He started using weapons at the end of it, you know what I mean? He's the kind of guy who would beat your butt and talk to you at the same time. You know, just almost read you a book, you know what I mean, you know? And then you get to that point where you're not going to cry. You just let him wail on you. You just let them just beat the snot out of you. You know what I mean? And I knew I was going to get it that night. And I went home, and the old man put me in my bedroom, and he slammed the door, and I'm going, God, what's he going to get? He's going to get a pier piling or something, man, and just nail me. And he didn't do a thing. I wake up that next morning and look out the door, and everybody's gone, you know. Looking out there, where's he at, you know? And the only thing that he did is he put a big lock on his bar. You know, a big old lock, man, like one on Davy's locker or something, you know, because he knew what was in that room. You know what I mean? And the moment that that happened, my dad began to look at me like he's got a lion in the house, man. He knew what was going on. And my life shifted. My life immediately shifted that day. I no longer worried about what I was going to do when I graduated. I never thought about school. The only time I'd ever go to college was to steal cars, you know. And I just started going. And you know what? And the older I got, the easier it was to get. There was liquor all around the house. I didn't have to go hustle it or anything. My dad had that cheap Thunderbird wine in there, and he had all of his whiskey out in the garage, and I was into it. And the older I got, the more I leaned on it. And the more responsibility that you're supposed to have, all it did was make me thirsty. And I avoided all that stuff by just drinking it away. Now, I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day and lose my paper out and come to AA or nothing like that, you know. But I never forgot that spot, because it would be a spot that I would visit time and time and time again. And the problem with me and the problem with a lot of folks here tonight is that little window. The longer I drank, the smaller it got. And the smaller it got, and the smaller it got. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't stepping into nothing. But there was a hope, and there was a dream, and it was the same hope and the same dream that we all had at the very end. Maybe this time it'll be different. I've got to find a way to keep this stuff in my life if it's the last thing that I do. And I grew up my entire life, like a lot of us did, trying to live out the lie, trying to try the lie, trying to apply the lie with these countless veins. And what is that lie that I'm talking about? The lie is this, that if you stop drinking, everything will be all right. God, how I tried that so many times. That's what made me feel so different, is that I stopped drinking and I'm not all right. And it seems like sobriety drives me to drink. That the longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And that no matter what condition of my life is, no matter how much I wish, and no matter how much you want me to, the longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And I don't know what to do about that. Because the only thing that not drinking ever squeezes out of me is this idea that this time it'll be different. Go ahead and start with some beer. Just have some shots. Just have 3 shots. And just kind of watch it. When you start getting numb, just back off. I didn't know I had a phenomenon of craving, that after the first shot, it's not up to me. I didn't know that I had a disease called, or illness called alcoholism, that it isn't even up to me anymore. That I'm powerless. That I'm an alcoholic. Everything in me is faced that way. I'm designed to drink. I am doing the unnatural. The power in my life has been that the saving grace has been alcohol. That's the only thing that kept me from hanging myself, for God's sake. And I didn't know that it was going to turn on me. And the older I got, the more I drank. And by the time I got into high school, I started hanging around these Mexican guys, and we love cars, and we used to lower our cars down. We used to lower them right down to the ground. I had a 62 Chevy Impala, long car, like a submarine, dropped right down to the ground. We'd lower our cars and raise our hair. I had my big hair. It looked like a tumbleweed, you know what I mean? You know, and we would drive around and listen to the Four Tops and the OJs and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson. Man, I loved it. You know, I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my dick, you know. I had my hair up real big. I had these white T-shirts with black khaki pants that came up to here. My girlfriend's friends are telling her that men who are well endowed had big feet. So I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in. I had my big hair and my big feet, you know, and somebody tripped over my foot tonight and I felt proud, you know what I mean? You want me to move that thing, you know what I mean? It may take a while, you know what I mean? Oh, I loved it, man, you know? I loved it. And Loopy had big hair. She used to curl her hair with these soup cans and the noodles were stuck in there, you know? And we'd drive around and drink that whiskey and wonder what the hell you're looking at. We got our frowns on our face because our butts hurt from bouncing around all night, you know? And one day we were drinking that 151 rum all day long. Drinking that 150 a month, all day long, man. Around 4 o'clock, Loopy says, let's drive into the Jack in the Box and talk to the puppet. Now, the Jack in the Box is a hamburger stand. I don't know if they have them out here. It's a hamburger stand where you got to talk to the puppet. I want one hamburger and one French fry, right? Like the son of a bitch is listening, you know what I mean? She goes, drive up to the Jack in the Box, you know? We were a lonely couple, so I didn't, you know. So I pulled up, and I wanted to talk to the puppet, and I'd been drinking all day, and I see about 10 puppets, you know what I mean? You know, and I see all these puppets, and I'm trying to pick out the right one, you know, and I run in there, and I, can I have your order, please? And I run over the puppet. His head's hanging down like that. The cops come. They arrest me. They throw me on the hood of the car. My hair shatters all over the place. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. Let Rudy drive. And there ain't nothing like being on the passenger side riding shotgun. There ain't nothing like that, man. You get to bounce around all night and drink those little half pints and make that magic discovery that every alkie makes. How good looking you are in that mirror. Oh, man. You want to get an alkie's attention, put a mirror in front of him. Oh, you should have seen him in the restroom. They all had bald heads, and they were going, oh, man. You know, and man, I looked at myself in that mirror, and I said, oh, my God, you ought to be an underwear model. You know what I mean? You don't wear any, but what the hell, you know what I mean? And you look in that mirror, and your hair is all straight and flat because you've been sleeping on the window all night, you know. You've got 30 pounds of hamburger puke on your chest, and you feel like dancing. You know what I mean? And I do. I love to dance, man. I look at myself in that mirror, and we've got those kind of bars where you can hear the music two blocks before you get there, man. Boom, 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 boom. And one night, man, we go by this bar, the Bounty Room, and I see my salsa queen in there. Oh, she's way in the back. She's back by the bar. Her hair's all big, you know what I mean? She's got flies stuck in her hair. She's got 30 pounds of hamburger puke on her chest. And she's back there gnawing on a pickled pig feet, you know. I like that about a woman. And I got to talk to her, man. And we pull into this bar, man. And I go back there and I'm going to make my move. And now my feet are so big and I'm so drunk, I feel like I'm skiing. I just... You know what I mean? And I go sliding up to that gal, man, and we have one shot of tequila, right? And her lesbian girlfriend comes over and beats the snot out of me like that. And I'm no dummy. I don't want to fight, you know. Love and peace is the answer, you know what I mean? But my feet are so big that they're caught between the foot rail and the bar, and I can't get out. I keep coming up, and she keeps nailing me, man. I keep coming up. I found out that night that I was a victim of gay bashing. She kicked the snot out of me for 2 hours, man, you know. And I loved every minute of it, man. I loved it. And I knew that me and Pooch and Loopy, We were going to bounce off into the sunset, man. Every time I drank, I stepped into that spot. And everything that I put in my system was working, you know. And around 1969, a lot of folks are going different places. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? So I got my buddy, and I thought we'd go back to Detroit, Michigan, and find my roots. And I wound up in Phoenix, Arizona, which is about 300 miles from L.A. It's all desert, you know, a couple cowboys. And here I am in Phoenix, you know. I'm at the Apache Hotel. It's about five floors high. Everybody has a bathroom. It's in the lobby. It's $30 a month. You have one window about the size of that speaker. You have a Murphy bed that comes out of the wall, and you look out that window, and you drink, and you dream, and you die. And you know, one of these days, it ain't going to be like that. One of these days, it's going to be different. One of these days, I'm going to have some things and do some things, and I'm going to get out of this little place, you know. And I find the Wagon Wheel Bar. And the Wagon Wheel is a great little pub. Has no windows. Just a dirty curtain blowing out of it, you know. And I find a guy named Ernie, and Ernie's from Tennessee. And he says, I know what you can do. He says, come by here in the morning. He says, I know a plumber, and he'll put you right to work. And so I show up in that morning, you know, and have a couple shots, and I meet this plumber. He says, yeah, come with me, son. Takes me out to the desert and sticks me underneath a house. He says, all I want you to do is hang copper. That's all I want you to do. And he gave me a transistor radio, and he says, I'll be back in 9 hours. And he took off. And I'm underneath this house. I got a transistor radio. I've got a pint of PM bourbon, my lunch, you know. And I'm crawling around underneath this house, and I see this cat over here, and I'm going, my God, I got it made under here. I'm on top of the world, man. I've got a pint. I've got a transistor. I got a new pet, you know. I mean, you know, things are looking good in my life, you know. And so I started drinking that hot bourbon under there. And 9 hours later, they come back and they drag me out from underneath that house. You know, I got drunk and I broke up through the floor. I robbed the lady of all of her jewelry. They're dragging me out. This little cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know, and they put me away for 2 days, you know. And I come out of that thing and I go back to the bar, and Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. And I'm thinking we're going to start working out. You know what I mean? And he gives me a bag of speed. I don't do speed. All right? I just drink and do heroin and mind my own business. You know what I mean? I'm not going to be no Afghan maker. That's for damn sure. You know what I mean? And he says, why don't you just take this stuff and I'll be back in 2 months and we'll go weigh you in. And he took off. Right? Well, he comes back 2 weeks later, and I haven't moved an inch in my little room. I just, you know, I'm busy in my room just chasing a fly around my room going, what's that? What's that? You know, looking out my little window, you know. I look out my little window, and I, you know, and I see these black and white flashes that are just killing me, man. And it's the damn sun going up and down, you know what I mean? He comes back there, you know, and anything that's white and it's on the floor, I'm firing it up, you know. It could be a toenail. I'm firing that crap up, you know. And he comes back and he says, you couldn't have possibly taken all that, you know. Well, I did, Ernie, you know. I'm all white. I got white stuff in my eyes. I got white, my hair straight up. I'm just busy beating my eyes into the next day, you know. He goes, you couldn't have possibly taken, well, I did, Ernie, you know. You can put a saddle on me and ride my ass around here, you know. So we canned that idea, you know, and went back down to the bar and met another plumber. And I started working for this plumber. I think I worked for him for, I don't know, maybe 2 hours, you know. And I had it with him, you know. I found out that he was younger than me, and I ain't working for a kid. I got my pride, you know. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. And I went to the county hospital, and they wrote me a prescription for Percodan. And then the doctor left my room, and he left me a box of blank prescription pads that he wanted me to have, you know. So I took that box, and I'm running down Central Avenue, duck into the Wagon Wheel Bar, and Ernie sees these things, and he makes a phone call to some guy out in Arizona, and we start writing prescriptions and selling them. start writing prescriptions for stuff like Seconal and Nebutol and Tuinol and you name it all. We wrote it all, you know, and damn near took it all too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. Now, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know what I mean? They're not helicopter. Oh, there he goes down to 17. You know, he's going over the Clyde now, you know. None of that stuff was happening. I was going 9 miles an hour. The cop was on foot. He was just walking around. He just rolled down the window, you know. I'm in my car, and I see this guy running after me, and I'm thinking, my God, can this son of a bitch run? You know what I mean? He throws me out of that car, arrests me, and they send me to an institution for about 10 months, and I come out of there, and they write me in 1974. They get me a voucher, and they send me back to Los Angeles, California, where I'm supposed to meet my probation officer and stuff. And they give me a little room, and I'm in this little room in downtown Torrance, California. It's about $30 a month. Everybody has a bathroom. It's down the hall, you know, same old thing. And in 1974, I'm on probation. And for the first time in my life since I'm 13, I'm not on anything. I don't have any alcohol in me. I'm totally clean. And they put me on stuff called Anabuse. And I'm taking this Anabuse, and I don't have any. In 1974, I'm about 2 months without drinking. And my probation officer gives me a little voucher to go for a job interview part-time to be a janitor at a refinery. And I'm taking a bus because I ain't driving until I'm 30. And you know, when you take buses, you're never on time. You're 2 hours early or you're 2 hours late. You know what I mean? And I take this bus to El Segundo, California for my job interview, and I got 2 hours to wait. And I go to a baseball diamond, a little league baseball diamond over there, and I'm sitting in this dugout, and I go absolutely out of my mind, stone cold sober. I become hysterical and maniacal, and my paranoia becomes so intense that these hallucinations begin to happen and they stick. I become somewhat catatonic, and I go into a place that I never want to forget. And somebody calls the paramedics. And the paramedics and the ambulance comes and gets me, and they send me over to the Harbor General Hospital, and I'm in an observation room. I've got one leg and one arm tied, and they're looking at me, and they're going through their paperwork, and they seem to think that because of some of the things that have been going on in my life, that maybe I need to go to a state hospital, that maybe I need to be observed mentally for 30 or 60 days. And they send me away to this asylum, this institution, and a year later, they let me out. And they didn't find anything either, you know what I mean? They put me on some medications that would take care of these mental things, and they did. And after about 2 months on this stuff called Thorazine, they find me over at Alvaro Street in Skid Row of Los Angeles at a Chevron gas station, curled up like a dead dog. And they send me up to the L.A. County Jail, and I'm up there at Wayside Honor Ranch, and I'm up there for about 40 days. And after about 40 or 50 days, they put about 50 or 60 of us in a black and white jail bus and send us down to the South Bay Courthouse in Torrance, California, where I'm going to be sentenced to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary. And I'm in a holding tank about this size. And at the end of the day, all the guys that I came in on the chain with are gone. All the buses are gone. All these other guys are gone. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag with all my clothes in it and no hope. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the only thing that I'm hoping for is that I can hear some keys. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. He slid open that door and he said, "Aye, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." And I thought, my God, who's this Scottish pirate, you know? And what's AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And looking back well over 35 years, I know exactly what that man was. Because like I said last night, this room tonight is sprinkled with a couple of them. And he's what my book calls a trusted servant. And what would make Alex a trusted servant in my heart and soul is simply this. He had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel for AA. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a refinery worker. And he got the worst news of his life. And the news was that his little wife was doing bad. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his home group, somewhere in his book study in Scotland, somewhere in his step study in America, the man was sitting with you guys in a home group and grasped and developed a manner of living that ingrained in him this. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. And that thought came through his mind, and he turned his little Chevrolet around, and he went to the South Bay Courthouse, and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, I think we got a guy for you. And that man took me to my first meeting of alcoholics in 1975. He says, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. And man, he nailed me right there, because if there's anything that I've ever felt, my entire life was different. That no matter who I'm with and what I'm doing, I've always felt different. He says, lad, he says, I can't wait to take you to alcohol. He says, I can't wait for you to meet these people. He loved you. He says, I can't wait for you to meet these people. He says, Larry, and he says, you don't have to worry about feeling different, son. In Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. He says, nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted. And the man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And I was ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch. You know what I mean? He takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he rolled up to this dingy, stinky, rotten, filthy AA clubhouse, the Torrance Lamita Alano Club. What is an Alano anyway? You know, is that like an elk or a moose? You know what I mean? Watch for crossing Alanos, you know? And he pulled up to this Alano Club, and there's all the Alanos walking around, you know. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo. He introduced me to Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. I said, my God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. And Little Moose come running across the parking lot. Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are. I said, I'm not it, you know. And some big transvestite came out of the card room, and he starts circling me like a helicopter in Los Angeles, you know. And after about three times around, this transvestite comes up to me and says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. I says, I don't think so, you know, not till I get a year anyway, you know. And I told Alex, I says, my God, he's got big feet, you know. And Alex took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And I looked around this room and I says, I don't want what they have. I don't want what they got. And I was different. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the biggest lie that I was telling myself. I hadn't touched AA. I did what I've been doing my entire life, ever since I was 13. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I've had my hand out my entire life, whether it be in a room from the state or the county or AA or whatever room. I've always sat in a seat waiting for what you were going to do for me. I've had my hand out my entire life, and I had no idea that what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me. You see, but I wasn't like that. And from 1975 to 1982, I wandered around these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, caught in that miserable cycle that we're caught in, staying drunk as long as you can, staying sober as long as you can, staying drunk as long as you can, staying, and there's no peace. There is no peace. All through that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson threatens the alcoholic with that word, peace. Oh, you'll know peace. Oh, yeah. You'll have peace. You know what I mean? You'll enjoy peace of mind. It's almost like he's threatening us with it. You know what I mean? Like he's dangling the carrot. Watch it. You're going to have peace. You know what I mean? Don't go near us, you know, because people like me don't know peace of mind. I don't know peace of mind. I know how to feel good. And feel good is from the outside in. Peace of mind is from the inside. That no matter what's going on around you or within you or about you, you're okay right here. That you are enough in what you're doing and your way of life. I've never had that. I've always had to arrange life. I've always had to start changing stuff. I never had that peace of mind or that serenity that our book talks about. You know? I've always been restless and irritable and discontent. And not the discontent you get from too much coffee. That discontent that no matter where your life is and what you're doing, it's never enough. You're constantly changing and moving around and doing this, and everything else has got to be moved around, and it just makes you miserable. And you're never happy with anything, but you're sure it's their fault. You know? And I had no idea what was going on. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they were always clean and they were sharp. And that's why I wear a tie and a coat for you folks in Scotland. Not because I think I'm smart and effective, but because you told me how to hold a job and show respect for the thing that's saving my life. I've never had respect for anybody. Every fight that I've ever been in when I've been locked up is over one thing: lack of respect, disrespect. And you guys taught me all about respect. You taught me about respect by taking care of the meetings that I'm sitting in. You taught me about respect for showing respect for the folks sitting next to me. That if I want to sit in a meeting and have my face glowing because I'm texting somebody is my business, but maybe there's some young man with 15 days whose life depends on every word that happens here. You see, but I'm not like that. I don't think about anybody else. I think about me and that emergency message that I got to be reading, and, you know, like I've got a liver coming to me or something like that. You know what I mean? For God's sakes, leave it in the car, you know? But selfish, self-centered people like that aren't concerned about other people in these rooms. And I wasn't. And I was like that. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, this Montana cowboy would always get me, Don. And Don would always tell me one thing: you ready to go to a meeting? And he'd come and pull me out of that little alley or wherever I was and take me to a meeting. And I would get physically sober and then I would leave. Because I would do what people would do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you see them doing it here. You see them doing all right. I came to get my life together. I came to get some order in my life. I came to get my life together and get that job and get that woman and get that car. Those things that I've wanted all my life, but I couldn't keep them going at one time. I know that if I get all those things, everything would be all right. And isn't that amazing? That's exactly what you see happening in Alcoholics Anonymous. People come here, they stop drinking, they get a car, they get a girlfriend, they get a job, and to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. We got folks in here who couldn't fit another car in their driveway, and they're restless, and they're irritable, and they're discontented, and they're sitting in the answer looking for an answer. That's because the solution to this deadly illness and malady has nothing to do with the material. The solution to this malady will be and always will be for people like me and you is me, you, and that book and the perpetuation of this gift. That's what they're hoping happens to you. The most beautiful picture in Alcoholics Anonymous is that man on the bed and those two guys talking to him. What do you think they're talking about? Hey, you better work more overtime. I don't think that's what's happening in that picture at all. The most beautiful story in Alcoholics Anonymous is Bill laying in that hospital bed time and time and time again. And Bill Wilson's finally at the town's hospital for his hopefully his last time. And his childhood friend, Ebby, comes and visits him. And Ebby starts taking him through these proposals. He just didn't lay in that bed and have a spiritual experience. If you read that book, Ebby starts taking him through the steps. He starts talking about his life and how powerless he is over the drink. He starts talking to him that maybe it's time to consider a power greater than yourself. He starts talking about the people that he's hurt. He starts talking about the people he owes money to. He starts talking about these defects of character. And before the man leaves there and takes off, Bill has this blinding flash in the window. He has this immediately feeling of an uplift and the wind blowing through him and this light. And he has what our book calls a spiritual experience. And for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think that that's what's supposed to happen to me. And little did I know that two paragraphs down, Bill is still in that bed. 10 seconds after that spiritual experience, he has this thought: I need to find other drunks. Now, how many of you were thinking about that on your first day? That was his first thought. I need to talk to other drunks. And it's come to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been my experience that that's exactly what's supposed to happen to people like me as a result of these steps. That maybe I'll be inspired to carry this message. What type of experience would that be that didn't include God and the carrying of this message? It would be just one more spiritual emotionalism for me. And I had no idea that that's what he's hoping happens to me. That maybe this isn't about just getting me sober and going off to work. That maybe Wilson is hoping that I do something with this message. That maybe we're supposed to be of love and service and carrying this message. That maybe that's our primary purpose, is to carry this message. Not from up here, but from down here where we live. And I had no idea what was to happen to me. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me, and they were always clean and they were sharp. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm at the Beacon Light Mission in Long Beach, California. I'm 120 pounds and I'm yellow. I go by a Woolworth window, a department store, and I look at myself in this window. I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? I never had any dreams. The only dream that I've ever had is maybe this time it'll be different. And I did what I always did when I got that way. I called up Alcoholics Anonymous. I called up Alcoholics Anonymous, and who do I get? I get that bald-headed carpenter. I get that Montana cowboy. I get Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm over here at the Beacon Light Mission. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. He says, why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I thought, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know what I mean? Well, I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by my nonsense. And I took the longest walk of my life. And right after he hung up, I went around to that mission, and I turned around this corner, and I sat on a little street corner, and I started crying. I started crying because everything in me wanted the life that you had. Everything in me wanted to stay sober. And I knew I was going to drink again. And I came to believe at that moment. And I didn't come to believe in God at that moment. And I didn't come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous at that moment. And I didn't come to believe in the book at that moment. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life at that time. And that I knew that I was going to drink. That I was powerless not to drink. That I was like a tail on a kite. It was just a matter of the wind coming and I'm off. And I didn't want to do that. And I was so afraid that I was going to, because I'd been in that position before. You see, I'm an alcoholic. The memory of my last drunk has never had sufficient force to keep me sober. And I used to hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I stay sober because of my last drunk. The memory of my last drunk, no matter how nasty it was, never have had enough force to keep me sober. Why is that? Because of the pain that I feel when I'm not drinking. Washes it right out of the picture. And I'm not drinking because of any memory of a disgusting moment. I'm drinking because of the pain that I feel now that I'm facing that disgusting moment. And the longer that I stay sober, the worse I feel. I'm an alcoholic. No matter how long I've been rolling around with those pigs, I know what's going to happen to me. I'm an alcoholic. I've got the memory of everybody that I've ever hurt and terrorized in my life playing pictures in front of me. And I'm an alcoholic. And every time I'm sober, I see those pictures. And I know what's going to happen to me. And I know the threats of institutions, but I'm an alcoholic. Every time that I stop drinking, it's just a matter of days and maybe a week and maybe a month that the only thing that ever squeezes any peace in me is this thought that maybe this time it'll be different, pal. I know what's happened to you, but ma'am, you got a shot at it this time. Because if you don't drink, you're stuck with the way you feel now and you don't have a chance because I'm ready to hang myself. And I know I'm not ready to go for it again. And I did what I made the longest walk of my life. I walked that 10 miles and I walked to that little Alano club with the only thought to talk to that Montana cowboy. And at every liquor store I seen, my head was saying, duck in here, man. Let's grab that half pint. And for the first time in my life, my head didn't have power over me. Because all I could think about was that Montana cowboy. And I walked into that AA clubhouse. And I said, do you know where Don is? And they said, well, he's back at the coffee bar. And I walked up to Don and I asked him something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" And that man lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for 20 minutes. And he gave me the agreement plan. He gave me the AA contract, and it was simply this: you make the effort, I'll make the effort. If you don't make the effort, don't bother me, Larry. I've got guys that I sponsor who want to do this. And I fell in love with my sponsor. I wanted this thing more than I wanted everything before in my life. Your book says we gave ourselves to this simple program. We gave ourselves. What's the only thing I've ever given myself? King alcohol. I gave it everything I got and then some. I gave it every opportunity, every dream, everybody that ever loved me. I gave it to them. It was up there. It's all yours. Anything for a shot. I gave my life and everybody else's to it. And then I read in Alcoholics, and I'll never forget this. I'm about 2 years sober, and we're reading Dr. Bob's story. And at the end of Dr. Bob's story, he says that at the very last, he says, if you put in half the effort into Alcoholics Anonymous that you did in your drinking, that you got a shot. He caught me. He nailed me with my laziness. I've been given things a half a shot my entire life, man. And he had me. I mean, all I got to do is give half? I'm all for that. You know what I mean? And I figured I could do that. Just half? You don't want? You got it. You know? And he nailed me. And I started following this sponsor. And that first night that I was sober, I stood up at that Thursday night meeting with everything I owned on my back. And I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't go to a treatment center. I got sober right on the street. I shook it out with the drunks. I shook it out in your car. They told me to stay there all day when I wandered into that Alano Club my first day. And I'm sitting next to a couple in alcohol, Frank and Lucille. And I remember shaking and those audio visuals and the hallucinations. And I knew that I were going to stay. And they gave me honey and orange juice. And they stood me up that night. And I remember raising my hand saying that I'm Larry Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like a guest. For the first time in my life, I felt like a member. For the first time in my life, I was ready to follow somebody else's direction. Because I knew I was a result of 30 years of me making the decisions. And I gave myself to that sponsor. And at the end of the meeting, he was taking me back to the mission. And he says, and he makes a left turn. And I said, where are we going? He says, you're going to my house. You're going to stay over at my house tonight. And I thought, this is great. I could already smell the pancakes and the toast and stuff, you know. And he takes me to his house and he sticks me in an abandoned camper shell. You know, like they put on the back of the trucks. He has it up on wood. He says, get in there. You know, like it's an oven. You know what I mean? Get in there, you know. And he sticks me. I said, I don't want to be in here. He says, no, you're staying in there all night. And he slammed the door. And I'm in this little camper shell. I'm going, what did I do to deserve this? You know what I mean? And he comes back and he opens up the little door. And he says, you better find a God while you're in there, hot shot. And he closed that door. I said, where are you going to find a God in the camper shell? You know, is he in the glove box or something like that? And I'm in this abandoned, like I felt like a captured wolf or something, you know what I mean? And I'm in this camper shell, and about 3:30 in the morning, I'm hallucinating. I can see the trees breathing and stuff. And the thought dawned on me. The thought dawned on me that I don't have to do this anymore. That this will be the last time I ever have to have the DTs. That I'll never have to shake it out again. I'll never have to return to this spot again. And you see, that was the miserable part of my life, is that no matter how nasty it was, I was always winding up in the same spot. And I thought to myself, I'll do whatever this bald-headed carpenter says. I'll let him have me. And it was the first step in a surrender that I've ever had. I left this guy, and he was my first sponsor, and I love him. I love him to this day. He'd been passed away for a long time. But I remember the relief of finally letting you have me. Just follow these folks, man. Just do the simple little things. And my life began to change. And it didn't change automatically. But for the first time in my life, I'm walking with something. For the first time in my life, I'm walking the streets and I got my head held high. For the first time in my life, I'm not dodging folks and running across the other side of the street. For the first time in my life, I've got two shoes that look alike. You know what I mean? For the first time in my life, I've got a boss that I'm surrendering to. For the first time in my life, I can hold my mom and tell her that I love her. But for the first time in my life, you were the most important people in my life. You became my primary purpose. You were the most important thing in my life and will always remain the most important thing in my life. And I know what it's like to be sliding in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous year. I know what that is like. You're not different. The only thing that I did with that is I tried to go around telling everybody else the lie. And you'll hear it all the time from people like me who can't stay in AA. And they tell you stuff like this. AA don't work for me. AA don't work for me. AA don't work for me, Larry. And I've come all the way to Scotland to tell you this. AA don't work for me either. It doesn't work for Eddick. It doesn't work for Derek. It doesn't work for Lindsay. It doesn't work for Carl. We work for it. That's the difference. We work for it. Our life has become on a service plane. It ain't about getting anything. Your getting days are over. There's nothing to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't even get sober here. You do that at the hotel. There's everything to receive. The only thing that you're going to get here if you're new is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man. Because this is the longest thing I've ever done against my will my entire life, man. I didn't wake up and go, yippee, let's go to Paisley and stay on a plane with people that smell like garlic in your goddamn flight. You know what I mean? But isn't it amazing how people like me and you have to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable? And the first thing that we want to do when things start going a little weary in our life is we want to start changing the formula. We want to start rearranging the formula that got us there. If you're new, the problems that you're going to have won't be getting a wife or losing a wife. It won't be about folks dying. It won't be about newborns being brought in. It won't be about the loss of job or the advance in your career. Your biggest hurdle, if you're new, will be the good life that you're going to live. Your good life will become so good that you'll be beginning wanting to cut off the thing that gave you life. You will be telling everybody about your blessings, every birthday you have, and how you've been blessed with her, and you've been blessed with this, and you've been blessed with that. And then old-timers like me get to watch you hang yourself with your great blessings because you keep not returning to the place that blessed you when no one else would. You are my greatest blessing. You are the finest thing that I've ever had in my life. And it's not only my duty to be with you and to do what's asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. As my book says, it's a privilege. It is a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a privilege to be among the finest people that I've known. And we are sitting in a, we are not the miracles. We are sitting in the miracles. The miracle in my life has been the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people in my life, collectively together, have given me a power that I've never been able to tap into before in my life. I'm not much about spirituality, but I can tell you this. Friday night? Saturday night? What is it tonight? Friday? It's hard to tell. But on a Friday night in Paisley, I see row after row after row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. Watch us all weekend long. We're happy and we're joyous and we're free. Our looking days are over. That is the miracle of my life, is that the search is over. We've been searching our entire life for that thing. We've been looking everywhere, but we never knew what the problem was. Everything that you need to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that you need that you're not happy with will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll remove everything and add everything you need. You don't need to go anywhere else. You are sitting in the answer. Serve that answer and be loyal to it and love it. Find a book and be loyal to it and love it. And tell somebody what's happened to you. Tell somebody about this thing that you've been sitting in. Tell somebody that one night you sat in a room and you seen row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane, and realize that the miracle of your life is you get to play in that evidence one more time. And thanks for having me.
Thank you, Larry. It was certainly a privilege for me to sit and listen to your strength, your hope, and your experience. I thank you again, mate. And that just came to the end of tonight's meeting. Time is 10:05. If you don't have to rush away and you've got some time, you can have a wee coffee or a wee tea or a wee biscuit if there's any left. I think the biscuits went down well tonight. And you can have a wee bit of fellowship. Tomorrow morning, we're back here for 10:30. Larry starts sharing at 10:30 on the 12 traditions. So if you want to listen to the 12 traditions, get here early, book your seat. Doors open, Big Eric says, 9 o'clock, 9:15. And if you come with an appetite, there's plenty of hot pies with brown sauce. So as I say, nice bit of fellowship, and have a safe journey. Thank you very much. Cheers. Yeah, don't go anywhere until we say the serenity prayer.